looking at me, but I do what I want. Don't give a fuck at all. Looking for something sweet. When it comes time to eat, you better start to run when I call. 'Cause I know that you don't really know how to handle it. So get down on your knees and get ready to become my bitch. I'm just a freak.
Thank you. the everlasting Sex Pistols. And our beautiful country, where we come from, dirty, dirty Deutschland. Thank you.
is The Real Story from the BBC with Owen Bennett-Jones, and this week we're going broad and wide, big picture. Who'll be running the world in 20 years' time? Will it be multipolar? Will it be Cold War Mark II? How will the West adjust to whatever new circumstances arise? In an unguarded moment, when he was saying goodbye to his host President Putin on his recent trip to Moscow, the Chinese leader Xi Jinping made a farewell comment. Take care, dear friend, he said. Right now we are seeing changes the likes of which we haven't seen for 100 years. And we are the ones driving these changes together. And Putin said, I agree. Meanwhile, in Washington, President Biden is currently hosting the Second Summit for Democracy, a US initiative to promote its values. And when he opened the conference, Biden insisted, democracy is bouncing back.
When we gathered here in December of 2021, the sentiment in too many places around the world was that democracy's best days were behind us. Democracy had declined by some measures for 15 consecutive years. But this year, we can say there's a different story to tell. Thanks to the commitment of leaders and global gathered today and the persistence of people in every region of the world, demanding their rights be respected and their voices being heard, we're seeing real indications that we're turning the tide here. As I often say, we're at an inflection point in history here.
An inflection point may be, but how many really think the tide is turning in favor of democracy? President Putin, who began his time in power seeking more contact with the West, now rejects it out of hand as hypocritical, decadent, and power-hungry.
Dominion of the world is precisely what the so-called West has decided to stake in this game. But this game is a dangerous, dirty, and deadly one. It contests the sovereignty of peoples and nations, their identity and uniqueness, and has no regard whatsoever for the interests of other countries.
And many around the world agree with him. Faced with that attitude in general, and Ukraine in particular, there has been, at least to some degree, a coming together of Western nations, united in defence of Ukraine. The US may get frustrated by the amount of arms it has to put into a European conflict, but the EU Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, insists the EU will stand up for its values. It will defend them.
Yes, protecting our liberty comes at a price, but this is a defining moment, and this is the cost we are willing to pay, because freedom is priceless, honorable members. This is our principle. Freedom is priceless.
So there we are. That sets up the contours of our discussion today. And we've got a great panel to help us guide us through this. It's Evelyn Farkas, first of all, in the US, current executive director of the McCain Institute, a non-profit focused on democracy, human rights and leadership. And under the Obama White House, she was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia, Ukraine and Eurasia. So right on target with what's going on now. We have Martin Wolf. He is the chief economics commentator at the Financial Times, the author of a book just out, The Crisis of Democratic Capitalism, on the vulnerability of the West and the awkward marriage of democracy and capitalism and how to defend it. And Professor Steve Tsang, political scientist, director of the China Institute at SOAS at the University of London. So thanks all for joining us. And let's just try and understand, first of all, that Xi remark. It was a very interesting thing he said about driving changes not seen for 100 years along with Putin. Steve Tsang, as someone who's followed Xi and understands a bit of his thinking, what was he meaning?
China is seizing the moment to make those changes to dovetail the ambitions China has under Xi Jinping, codified in what Xi Jinping calls his China dream of national rejuvenation. And he also talks about creating a common destiny of the humankind, something that he first articulated in Russia in 2013, within a year of him ascending to power in China. That's what he's trying to do.
Yeah, but why would he think he's doing it with Putin when President Putin is, in breach of fundamental Chinese principles like don't interfere with other people's business?
Does Xi Jinping really believe that Putin is violating what is being claimed as China's principle of non-interference in somebody else's business? I think that is exactly the kind of conceptualization we have to address in terms of the new world order that Xi Jinping would like. There's one thing to articulate high-sounding principles. It's a different thing to see what actual actions are being taken. The Chinese call it hear the words, but watch the deeds.
Let's move to the US then, and Evelyn Farkas, how do you read the Xi Jinping remark to President Putin? Do you see it as an alliance against the West?
I do, actually. Essentially, what Xi is saying is that together we are trying to change the international order. Now, I do think that there's a difference between the two of them. Where they overlap, though, is it allows them to move together. Putin wants to actually go back to the 19th century sphere of influence. He would like to have no United Nations and just have the large states dictate to the smaller states their form of government, their external economic and political affiliations. And that's what he's trying to do with his neo-imperial conquest of Ukraine and Georgia and probably Moldova, if he can get away with that. Whereas Xi is trying to rewrite the rules of the international order, he's not outright challenging the UN Charter. He's saying, let's emphasize borders and sovereignty and the right of states to do whatever they want inside of their countries, and de-emphasize the other part of the UN Charter, which is, you know, human rights, individual rights, group rights, the right to protect. He and Putin agree 100% that the international order, that international community, other countries have no right to interfere in how you are treating your citizens. And they are also aligned because Putin wants to weaken America, wants to weaken the strongest political, economic, and diplomatic power that exists today still, the one that is, of course, willing and able to stand up to Putin's autocratic and neo-imperialist objectives. So right now, they are aligned in the effort also to weaken the United States, also to stand up to the United States and our allies, and to essentially try to assert their power against our power, if you will.
So, Martin Wolf, two ideas there, you know, defending non-interference as a principle and taking on the US. Which do you think is, of those two, is most important to Xi and Putin?
Both of them essentially want to do, as all great powers tend to, they want to do what they like, and they don't want anyone to stop them. And the only power that has genuine power and believes it has the right, in addition to stop them, is the West broadly and above all the United States. So they're against the U.S. domination of the international system and of any institutions that the U.S. might mobilize to hinder what they want to do. And they'll dress this up, of course, in all sorts of different fancy language, but ultimately it's about power. Even the U.S. has had moments of complete madness in exerting its power in the world and has made many mistakes. So great powers do things like this. I think the fundamental point to me anyway is we are at a period of real great power competition. Different ideologies are involved, of course, but also different economic systems. But above all, it's about the rising power of China, the revanchist power of Russia clearly in decline, and the US as the incumbent trying to preserve its system, which it believes in, and of course, one that I personally believe in too.
Let's just get more on the Chinese perspective. Dr. Henry Wang is the founder and director of the Center for China and Globalization, a think tank with links to the Chinese Communist Party.
China is trying to become a peacemaker. We are in a very troubled world now, and we have a lot of conflict, a lot of potential conflict. And if China can not only play a big economic role, but also a more mediating role, that should be welcomed by the world.
Because many in the West see it differently and think that China is set on global domination, that it's now competing with the United States, sometimes quite successfully, but that it is a competition.
No, I don't really think so. China never colonized any place. China never placed any soldier anywhere. China did not have any foreign military base. And
except it did, didn't it?
No, I don't think. So the world police is still the U.S. I mean, they have troops everywhere. They have a military base everywhere. And they basically still patrol the world right now. So through thousands of years of history, Zheng He, you know, the marshal in the 15th century, they have expedition seven times, overseas expedition in big voyage. Never stayed anywhere. You know, there's no DNA in the Chinese blood of occupying or take any territories or dominating the world. China is always satisfied with the big intercontinental land and agriculture economy. Confucius culture is always stay at home and doing things at home and trying to be good to the world.
Can I just ask you about Russia? And as you know, your president was in Russia recently, Russia, which, you know, you're describing China as a very peaceful country. I guess you'd agree that Russia isn't. We didn't hear much criticism of Russia's aggression. Why was that?
I think China has already quite strongly already said, you know, I mean, for example, the one war broke out, China Foreign Minister Wang, you already said sovereignty, territorial integrity of Ukraine should be respected. That's a very strong language. I mean, recent few months after, you know, German Chancellor Scholz's visit, China said no nuclear wars or nuclear weapons should be used.
Do you think the West is in decline?
I'm not thinking West is declining. You know, Western certainly has its own advantages. I mean, China has its own advantages. So everybody has its own problem. And just like I was talking to Martin Wolf 2 years ago, I mean, we both think that we should address our own problem rather than blame others.
And there you go. Mark, that was Dr. Henry Wang remembering a conversation, Martin, he had with you 2 years ago. So that shows you the weight of your words. What did you talk to him about and what did you make of what he just said there?
Well, I was talking to him entirely about the future of globalization and the breakup of the world economy, which we are clearly witnessing. It's gone much further since then. And the costs that was likely to impose upon the world economy. And he was talking about China being internally Pacific and so forth. That's another matter, which I didn't discuss.
Evelyn Farkas, let me put that point to you. You know, there he is saying China's peace-loving, no history of occupation, US, Iraq, Afghanistan, all the rest of it. And I think many people listening to this around the world will agree with that and say, you know, China hasn't, at least yet, shown the kind of aggressive international attentions that America has.
I would disagree with that. First of all, if you had an Indian, you know, expert on here, they would immediately point out that the Chinese have been violating the border agreement that they have between China and India, using military force, using military troops. And that was initiated by China. Second, China is harassing not just Vietnam, but the Philippine ships, Japanese ships. They're using what we call little green boats, you know, merchant ships, but they're really being commanded, directed by the Chinese military. And they're also now harassing freedom of navigation, and most recently trying to obstruct a U.S. the Navy vessel going through the South China Sea. And don't forget, a third of the world's commerce goes through the South China Sea. So the Chinese are trying to assert that they not only dominate it, but that they own it. As for the United States, you know, of course, yes, we have a military that we use. Each circumstance under which we use force is different. And we have done it in concert with other nations. We have always endeavored to also get the UN and, you know, international endorsement. We've made mistakes, but unlike China and many other authoritarian countries, we can admit our mistakes and we endeavor to do better because we have a democracy where you can have free, open debate and dissent within our country with regard to our wars.
Professor Tsang, let me just ask you how you read Chinese intentions.
First of all, responding to what Mr. Huang said in terms of his version of the history, anybody who provides a version of history that differs from the version of history of the Communist Party will have committed an offense. We are being told that China or the Chinese people do not have any DNA of imperialist or colonialist. And he is talking about a country that expanded from a small part of the Yellow River basins to a continental-sized country without ever committing any imperial acts. And people can judge that history for themselves. As to the intention of China and the peaceful side of it. Xi Jinping talks a lot about the most magnificent country, civilization, advanced country, that is China. So wonderful that everybody in the rest of the world will admire it, want to draw inspiration from it, copy its model and do what it does. And only for those countries that were naughty enough or ill-advised enough or silly enough to not be so inspired will require to be educated to behave properly. That's what is underlying the very peaceful conceptualization of this.
It's fine as long as you agree, basically, is what you're saying.
Well, basically, it's my way or the byway, except right. that if you go the byway, then you have to be bought into my way.
Yeah. Another way of looking at this is as we discuss the US and China, as we look ahead a couple of decades. So, Martin Wolf, can you compare for us, you know, the vulnerability of the democratic capitalism you wrote about in your book versus the vulnerability of an autocratic Chinese system that presumably could begin to crack at some point?
I find it very difficult to assess, particularly with a genuine expert, the likely political development of China, except to note that we haven't so far had a large, prosperous, advanced economy run by a near-totalitarian communist party. So it would be a novel and striking development if this were to happen. But if I look at it from an economic point of view, it's obviously crucial to assess how well the Chinese economy is likely to do over the next 20 or 30 years relative to the Western economies. The two things they have in their favor, despite demographic change, is they have an enormous population, almost double that of Europe and America together. And China is still a relatively poor country. GDP per head is probably about a half, perhaps a little bit less of that of the average developed country. And that merely suggests that they've got a long way to go before they become a developed country. And that would seem to imply that if they do reasonably well, they can become relatively much richer. And if they were to achieve the average income per head, GDP per head of a developed country, arithmetically, as it were, they would be far and away the biggest economy in the world on any plausible measure. At the moment, again, on plausible measures, China is probably about half the size of the Western system together economically. Now, then the question comes, can China continue to grow faster than the West over a generation and achieve that goal? I think it's conceptually possible, but they're going to have a number of very big problems. First, the world economy is clearly going to be much less favorable, much less accepting, above all, the West, which is a huge chunk of the world economy once you take China out of it. So markets, access to technology and so forth are going to be much more difficult to obtain. That's absolutely crucial. Second, China itself has shown very clear signs of very steep declines in efficiency of resource use, in technical progress, and so forth. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that they've done a lot of the easier things. But it's also to do with what I believe of the enormous mistakes of the Xi regime. I think Xi is a much worse manager of the economy because I suspect that he's much less interested than his predecessors. And the system created above all by Zhu Rongji, who I think has been the most important reformer of the Chinese economy under Deng Xiaoping, of course, this system is being dismantled. He is extremely hostile to the private sector. That may be temporarily in abeyance, but that's clear. He has enormous overhang of bad debt in his system. But I think if you add all this together, there has to be a question about how well the economy will actually perform. Of course, the West may not do that well either. So I would say there is some chance that China will become the dominant economy over the next generation, but I think it's very far from certain.
Evelyn Farkas, let me just switch this slightly over to the politics of it when trying to compare the fragility of the two systems. I mean, I guess in the post-war period, everyone thought American-style liberal democracy was very, very stable. And recent US politics suggests it's not. So is it really possible to say now that the US system is the most stable?
Clearly, Owen, the US system is under stress. And we have held the line on democracy. And I think there are real reasons to be optimistic. Congress has passed some historic legislation on a bipartisan basis. But, you know, outside actors and fringe actors inside the United States are working together to try to weaken our democracy. So the real question is how we deal with challenges, and democracies are better at learning and adapting than autocracies. And we have a system that is still attractive to young people from other countries. China is an aging autocracy. Who are they going to attract to come and be their labor force in the future?
Well, Professor Tsang, let me ask you about one aspect of this. I mean, we just heard that, you know, the West can adapt, and that's their strength. The Chinese have this astonishing surveillance system now over the population. Does that guarantee Chinese stability?
The big difference here is that your democratic system's resilience is structural, and you can have very poor politicians. The system somehow continues and struggles and a bit. It's a kind of a triumph of mediocrity, if you like. The Chinese system require the leadership to get it right all the time. And the surveillance state that you're talking about is the instrument that the leadership use to make sure that it can keep everything under control and in order. Now, in the short to perhaps even medium term, the capacity of the Chinese party state under Xi Jinping has been significantly strengthened. But when you get into the long to very long term, then they are not necessarily enough to compensate for the other problems that the party state will face. When the Chinese economy was doing miraculously well in the last four decades, because of the opening of the Chinese economy to the outside world and the large influx of Western capital and technology transfer into the Chinese economy, which make that Chinese economic miracle possible. Now, all that are going to become much more difficult to sustain moving forward. So when that happens, and if Xi Jinping's control weakens, or if Xi Jinping dies, what then will happen? Then your longer-term resilience will become much more difficult to sustain in the Chinese systems that require the leader and the leadership to get it right nearly all the time.
A reminder that you're listening to The Real Story from the BBC World Service with me, Owen Bennett-Jones. And this week, we're looking at the issue of who's going to be running the world in 20 years' time, who's up, who's down, what will it look like? And our panel today, Evelyn Farkas from the Obama administration, Martin Wolf, chief economics commentator at the FT, the Financial Times, and Professor Steve Tsang from London University. Now, let's just get a bit about Europe now. I should probably start with you, Martin Wolf, since you live in Europe and think about Europe. Where is the EU in this contest for global power and global economic success?
Well, first of all, I'm delighted you said that I live in Europe. As I constantly tell my friends in the EU, we're still a European country, and I'm still a European, and always will be. In answer to your question, the situation in which Europe now finds itself is a very uncomfortable one, because it would like to live in a nice, harmonious, peaceful world in which they can continue to do business in and with China, promote trade. Europe, and the EU in particular, has positioned itself as sort of a Pacific power, one without territorial ambitions and without military capacity, as the Americans have frequently complained. So they don't like this. Here, I think there are two things going on. One, they do wish to preserve, if they possibly can. This is particularly true of Germany, which is very dependent on trade and whose trade with China is enormous, at least as big as that with the US. And they want to preserve that. It's been a basis of prosperity, and it matters to them. The second point is that the Europeans have also become increasingly worried about Chinese economic policies, Chinese technological ambitions, Chinese appropriation of, some would say, theft of intellectual property. So they have become increasingly anxious and wish to contain China's economic pressure upon them and preserve their entrenched capacities. It's all very familiar from the past. And third, well, we're now moving, as was made very clear in our earlier discussion, into a period of a strategic contest, a conflict, and war. There's a war on the eastern end of Europe. And that changes everything. It's reinforced.